Thanks to Emma, Roz and Graham. It's a Friday, the 20th of December, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the rest of the hour, we'll be talking football with Alan Cawley and Fergal Brennan. Gavin Casey is on boxing. We'll have Jane Mangan on racing. Plus, we'll be crossing live to the Kingspan Stadium ahead of Ulster versus Munster.
Game On. Check out the podcast on the RTE Radio Player app.
Hi, welcome along. Delighted to say that Alan Cawley is with me in his studio. How are you, Alan? Having a great Friday.
Click that button, Marie. Click that button. I'm good. Yourself?
Yeah, all good. Looking forward to Christmas. Looking forward to the Premier League this weekend as well, though.
Yeah, Christmas. We're only is it 5 days out, Marie? 5 days. Yeah, looking forward to it. I love Christmas, I have to say. Yourself? Are you stressed out? Or are you okay? Or are you have it all under control?
No, I'm all good. I'm all good. I like Christmas as well. I like getting those few days off, but I like getting back into it too.
A chance for us country folk to get down home as well, Marie.
Get down home, catch up.
And absolutely.
Then, watch all the sport. Last night, Alan, it was a very, very interesting evening if you were watching the Man United Spurs game. I was actually watching and thinking there's a really good chance I could be a Premier League goalkeeper.
There's every chance, Marie, because I was looking, I watched that match as well, and I had the Rovers match taped, Shamrock Rovers, and I was I watched that back afterwards. I actually watched a good bit of it earlier on as well, just the goals, but we'll come to that. But the Spurs match, Marie, yeah, it was absolute craziness. So I'm looking at Pat Jennings in the stand and I'm thinking, what does Pat Jennings make of the modern day goalkeeping situation with Fraser Forster and the lad that played last night for, I think he must be the third choice keeper, Badi Yarkin, or the Turkish lad in goals for Man United, and just, I suppose, the added expectation now from the goalkeeper in terms of the playing out from the back stuff. Fraser Forster is kind of at the latter end of his career, and now he's been asked to do this, and the expectation on him when he can't do it, he's a good shot stopper but no good with his feet, as you'd expect from a goalkeeper, because hence while they're in the goals. But I suppose the modern day goalkeeper has that extra expectation now to be good with his feet, and that's fine for a young lad starting off in his career, that he can learn that and practice it and get better and better at it. But for the likes of him, yet they were still persistent with it. And surely the manager has to kind of take responsibility there and say, look, Fraser Forster is not capable of doing what maybe Vicario does, or what a better kind of goalkeeper with his feet does, so we won't ask him to do that. Yet they just persist with it. And even after he made the two howlers, they were still trying it. So I don't know. And the problem, I think Jamie Carragher, to be fair, summed it up quite well, Gary Neville in commentary, almost like they're like robots nowadays. Mm-hmm. And that's not a good thing. I don't think humans should be described as robots when they're playing a game that you have to make your own decisions in, because ultimately that's what it's all about, decision making when you are playing. And the better ones make the right decisions more often than not, the lesser ones make the wrong decisions. But if you have a manager who's kind of dictating to them that you have to do this and do this and do this at every moment of every match, I don't think it allows a player to flourish in that environment, or allows a player to even develop in terms of his own kind of personal development, because they just, anytime something goes wrong, they're just looking out to maybe the manager to say, he told me to do this and he told me to pass it here. That can't be the way. It just can't be the way.
Who's a good example of somebody that is able to still be themselves? Is Cole Palmer the only one at the moment?
Yeah, he's a good example, yeah. But I suppose because he has such natural ability, you'd be crazy to try and get in his ear as a manager and try and take away all the quality that he has in terms of the expression and how he goes out and just.
But he didn't do well in City, though.
No, maybe that's because, again, the criticism at the moment of the example, maybe, of you're using Cole Palmer, I suppose, a like for one, maybe at Man City, is Jack Grealish, and everybody is saying Pep has taken the flair out of him and taken that expression out of his game, and that it's so regimented that he has to stand and hug the touchline and, I suppose, work in a system that has been ultimately successful for Pep. Positionism, I think, to call it nowadays. And he's very much a positional coach, Pep Guardiola. But if you look at, I suppose, the beauty of Maresca, what he's doing at the moment, he has created, if you like, a formation or a setup that still allows Cole Palmer to flourish and be the flair player and have that freedom to do what he wants. And that should never be taken away, especially when you've someone as good as him. If they're not as good as him, I totally understand it and get it, and there's not many that are as good as him, but I still think in the game you need players who are especially technically as gifted as him. They need area and space to be allowed to flourish and play, and he's the prime example of it.
Yeah, he's absolutely brilliant. What about Shamrock Rovers last night, Alan, against Chelsea?
Yeah, just a bridge too far, really, Marie, and I suppose it's what we expected, despite the fact that they had largely a second-string team out, but still serious quality. If you go through Dewsbury Hall, and Cuckoo played, so they still had some kind of household names, but a brilliant experience, huge amount of away support as well, the fact that they scored. And to be fair to them, I don't want to do them kind of a disservice. For the first half an hour, they were very much in the game. The thing that I suppose that'll disappoint Stephen Bradley, because as much as they had the points on the board and it was a great occasion, you still want to give a good account of yourself and feel as though we can put it up to them, without ever thinking maybe we can get a result. But they certainly would have felt we could give a good account of ourselves. And they were doing that for the first half an hour. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that will disappoint Stephen Bradley most of all was the two goals they conceded so sloppily. And if you're... It's hard enough to beat teams like that. Just if you're even playing at your best, I think the phrase Stephen used was that you'd almost have to be faultless, and you do. One of our teams going up against the likes of that opposition, but if you're gifting them two goals as well, Marie, you're not giving yourself much of a chance. And I think that's what will disappoint Stephen more than anything. You look at Dara Burns for the first goal and people were critical of him. It's the goalkeeper I'd be critical of. I don't know where he's going, Leon Poles. He's running out there. Dara Burns is in total control of the situation. If he stays on his line or even advances as far as the 6 yard box and anticipates or reads that Dara, the only thing he can do is head it back to him, he just picks that up. But where he's going, Poles, I thought it was a poor one from him. Then a sloppy one from Dan Cleary with the back pass. He could flick it up the line, no problem. There'd be no issues. Plays a blind pass back to the goalkeeper. To be fair to the centre forward, he's only 18, scored a hat-trick. Goy, the guy from Barcelona, is very sharp, goes around the keeper. So I think that's the thing that disappoints Stephen more than anything, was the goals to give up. And that's been uncharacteristic of them in the group so far, hence why they have so many points and why they've done so well. But in terms of, I suppose, the whole night and the occasion, it was fabulous for them. It really was. And if their business done and now they're in the playoff, they can go with, a winnable tie against Molde. Not saying it'll be easy, it'll be difficult, but it's winnable.
How good are Molde, Al? I know they're finished way down, like 24th or something like that in the standings.
Fifth domestically they were in their own league. I just looked at it earlier on. So to be a decent team, Ray, we've seen them over the years. Solskjaer obviously was with them. They played Sligo Rovers a few years back. I'm nearly sure they played Shamrock Rovers recently as well in one of the last European games, and they beat them, and they were good. They will be strong, they'll be very powerful technically. They were quite good actually when I seen them in those games as well. But I think if Shamrock Rovers can take the form of what they have done so far in Europe into that game, Marie, it's winnable. It's very winnable. The beauty for them now is they'll have the break, they'll be back into pre-season, and by the time that game comes round, they'll be fully up to speed. I think that's another thing Stephen referenced after the match last night. The phrase he used was the mental sharpness wasn't there, because they haven't been playing week to week, and that's difficult as well, because our league finished, was it eight weeks ago, and it's been difficult for them when you're not playing week to week, I suppose, going up against the opposition, and they've handled it really well so far. It was just a bridge too far last night, and of course the opposition you're up against. But come after Christmas, I think he might strengthen as well. He might lose a couple. All the talk is Johnny will go back to Celtic. Well, it's not all the talk, I think it's confirmed he's going back to Celtic the 2nd of January. But the big one is Ferrugia as well. There's talk that he'll go. I'm not sure where he's going yet, but there's strong talk that he's going to leave. He signed Danny Grant, who I think is a good signing, good addition to the squad as well, particularly in those kind of wing back areas. I think he might get a tune out of Danny, but I think losing Johnny and Ferrugia will be a big loss to him.
Yeah, absolutely huge, and it'd be hard to replace them just quality wise. Like,
and especially what he's done with Ferrugia, I suppose, in this campaign again, because you look at the subs that came on last night, Jack Mandrio and Graham Burke, who we would consider all, not the luxury players, but the match winners, if you like. And in my view, three of the best in the league. They're absolutely phenomenal in our league. But in Europe, he's gone with more kind of a regimented system, legs, energies, played Ferrugia through the middle, and Ferrugia's flourished through the middle. He really has. Dylan Watts, Gary O'Neill, he's been brilliant. Hence why he's probably getting the move and why the interest is there. And that's, look, as much as it's a compliment to Stephen and Shamrock Rovers, that kind of is par for the course as well, Marie, that if you're doing really well, there's other teams out there that maybe want to take some of your better players as well. That's just the way football works.
Yeah, it's kind of bittersweet, because you want Ferrugia to move on and do well, but just given the how well he's played, like, he will be.
Yeah, and we've
replace.
Always, and if you even go back to, I think, when Stephen Kenny was the manager, Stephen was very keen on him.
He was so close, but he kept getting injured.
Close.
So he seems to have sorted that out now.
And that's the problem, Maria. It was always the problem for Neil. He was always a brilliant talent. I remember him even coming through at UCD, a brilliant talent, but he was always really unfortunate with the injuries, and they seemed to be real kind of niggly muscular ones more than anything. It wasn't like he had a broken leg or a cruciate injury or anything serious like that. It was niggly little things that used to persist all the time. But now, since I suppose the last probably 6 months, he's got a run of games, and look at the difference in him when he gets a run of games and the damage he can do, because he's a brilliant, strong, powerful runner, and in the modern game he's perfectly suited to I suppose how conducive it is to a fella who's built like him physically.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to bring in Fergal Brennan, who is standing by on Mersey's side. How are you, Fergal?
Very good, Marie. How's things?
Yeah, we're all good. We may as well start with Everton, because that takeover news has been attracting quite a lot of attention, and Sean Dyche was out speaking to the media as well today. So he met the new owners for the first time today, and it looks like he's going to be staying, and they might be backing him as well to strengthen his own squad.
Certainly in the short to medium term, the Friedkin group have been quite clear on that. The noise is coming from their media releases since it's been rubber stamped and signed off that they're taking charge at Everton. In fact, they've been quite positive about Sean Dyche, the fact that he's kept the club financially afloat and, most importantly, in the Premier League to keep that cash injection coming into Goodison Park every season. Certainly not in January. As it stands, not in the summer will they be looking to get rid of him. They know the value of a kind of stable setting, particularly in these early stages when they want to get themselves adjusted to the Premier League, what will be demanded of them from the fan base and from being the owners of a Premier League football club. So Sean Dyche will remain at the helm. Everton themselves, whilst there is obviously a lot of fan frustration, I do still firmly believe that they are in that clutch of sides that will be okay from relegation. There'll be probably a few hairy moments in the new year, but particularly at home when the going gets tough. It is the last season at Goodison Park as well, so there's lots of emotion and storylines attached to that. I do think they'll be okay. There will be money to spend in January. They have to be very careful though, because I think the last two or three transfer windows they've made some really poor decisions. Some of the players they've brought in just haven't been up to standard. There's been some good picks, but there's been a lot of money spent on players that are just not up to Premier League standards. So Sean Dyche, the money that he gets in January, he needs to be very, very careful who he spends it on.
Yeah, I've always liked Dyche, but I think there comes a point with him as well, especially it's different at the likes of Burnley, where you're always kind of hovering around that relegation area, and I suppose the ambition for them is never really going to kind of transpire into anything like European football or anything like that. Everton are a much bigger club than Burnley will ever be, and huge history, tradition, and there comes a point, especially moving into a new stadium, that the ambition has to kind of far outweigh just survival mode, and that's, I feel, what they've been in since Sean Dyche has come in. Now, I like Sean Dyche, I've huge respect for Sean Dyche, but to me, he's just a safe pair of hands. I can never really see him getting Everton into those positions where you look at the likes of maybe Villa have gone, or a Brighton, or a Spurs, or even Bournemouth. You look at the moment, like Everton are a bigger club than Bournemouth, and Fulham. You look at the job Marco Silva is doing, but I can never really see why Sean Dyche is there at Everton. Now, Fergal might think maybe it's down to transfer funds as well and money, and if that becomes available, but I just see him as a manager who will always just be a safe pair of hands, and a good manager, and a good Premier League manager, and that's not to take anything away from him, but I just feel as though if you're an Everton supporter, or you're investing in an Everton Football Club going into a big new stadium as well, and you have neighbours like Liverpool who were beaten all before them on the other side of kind of the city, there comes a point where your ambition has to be a little bit more than survival, and I just think that's where they are at the moment.
Yeah, they seem to just not be able, and actually it was interesting because in that Sean Dyche press conference today, Fergal, the reporters are asking all the time about Seamus Coleman and the role that he's playing in stabilising everything. It's just fascinating to see somebody like him, or to hear somebody like him, be placed as someone that is so integral to the club, like a senior player like that, to be associated with sorting out everything in the background, as well as being a player and a senior player and a captain too.
I mean, it speaks to his position within the club. He is the club captain, and when he plays, he is the heartbeat of that team on the pitch, full of passion, full of energy, organising, shouting, screaming where necessary. But off the pitch and any dealings I've had with Everton over the years, you do see that his influence has grown and grown and grown. He's such an important voice. He might not be the loudest in the conversation, but he's so well respected by the fans, by the people that run Everton Football Club in the past, and obviously now the new ownership. He's seen so many managers come through and then out the door at Goodison Park as well, that it's just that years of experience and the fact that his opinion is so valued. Because I'd agree with Alan that Everton, the position that they're in, survival mode, making sure that they're staying in the Premier League, but he's an individual that every season has shown that reliability, that when things have got difficult, he's come in, he's played a really important role, and that's what's gained this respect and affection from the club and the fan base. And he's such an important part of it that I think it's a natural step for new owners to say, who are the key stakeholders here? Be that a manager, be that a coach, or somebody involved in director of football in certain other settings. For Everton, Seamus Coleman is an enormous voice that maybe isn't replicated at other Premier League sides, but that's because of the personality that he is and the time served at Everton.
Yeah, we don't really get players staying that long anymore and being so important to clubs. Lots of really good games to look forward to this weekend. I'm really enjoying watching Man City play these days, Alan.
For all the wrong reasons, isn't it, Marie?
So they're playing Aston Villa, and well, it's just because I keep expecting them to, you know, move through the gears like they have in previous seasons, and it just doesn't seem to be happening. And now there's news that they've been dealt an even further bad run of luck with injuries. Ruben Dias now ruled out for up to 4 weeks with a muscle injury.
Yeah, I've heard that comment mentioned, Marie, what you just said there a few times in the last probably 3 or 4 weeks, that you look at the fixtures and people think, oh, they're just going to click into gear. I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't. I think they're in the mire at the moment. I'm not saying they're going to go on a continuous run like they're on. I think it's eight losses in the last 11. I don't think it's going to continue like that, but I can't see them winning 5 or 6 on the bounce anytime soon. That's certainly not going to happen. So I think they're going to be in the mire throughout the whole, for the rest of the season, I feel, until they get some players back as well. But I suppose the fascinating thing at the moment watching them is just the struggles that Pep Guardiola is having trying to even deal with the situation. And I don't think he's dealing with it very well, Marie, to be honest with you. So I think he needs to step up a little bit. Like, everybody's talking about the injuries, and which is definitely a factor, but I still think you have a decent enough team on the pitch that you shouldn't be losing 8 out of 11. And I think he needs to do a bit more. Everybody goes on about him like he's some sort of god when it comes to football, and he is, for all that he's achieved. But these are the times when you have to step up when it's kind of adversity and show your true colours. And I don't think he's dealing with it well at all. I've always felt, even when he was the serial winner that he was, the odd game that they might lose, he's a terrible bad loser. He's horrendous in interviews after the match, almost passive aggressive to people. And now you see him in a situation where he is losing and he can't cope, he can't deal with it. And I think he needs to step up, never mind the players.
Fergal, is it crisis mode?
I would agree with Alan that we're all kind of expecting this to end at some point, but they're not really showing the kind of mentality, the grit, the experience that you'd expect them to. We know there's so much talent in that team, but even the derby last weekend, as United were growing into the game and getting on top and getting on top, I didn't see them winning it. I thought they'd get an equaliser and it would be a draw. That just wouldn't have happened in previous seasons with Manchester City. But at the moment, from Guardiola on the bench to the players on the pitch, there just doesn't seem to be a unifying force or voice saying, we just need to manage this situation and we need to win this game, and then that will breed a bit more confidence to win another one and try and get some sort of a foothold back into this season. Because at the moment they are in free fall, because we all anticipate, because they've got these fantastic players, any game now they're just going to blow someone away and it'll magically all be back to normal. They will get back to winning games at some point, but there's been a lot of holes blown in them in terms of this idea that they're absolutely invincible and they'll win every game and you can't do anything against them. And the more games that, not necessarily that they lose, the more games that they show this kind of mental fatigue, the more teams like Aston Villa and others dotted all the way through the Premier League are going to think to themselves, we can have a go at these. We might not get another chance to have a real crack at Manchester City. Now is our time. And Guardiola is the leader of this team. He's the most influential figure at the club or outside of the ownership. He has to lead that. He has to lead that from the front. And that has to start this weekend, because if Liverpool and Chelsea potentially start to get away from them, it could be a long road back.
One thing as well, there's two major things that stick out for me. It's one thing to say come on lads, play with a bit of intensity and desire and energy, and a manager wanting that from players. But if you can't do that, Marie, physically they can't. Gundogan can't run. He can't move any more than what he's doing at the moment. Bernardo Silva is the same. De Bruyne is at the latter end of his career, so they can't play with that energy and zest and verve that we've seen with them for so long. You look at Doku, who is so hit miss at the best of times. You wouldn't be relying on him. When you think they had Riyad Mahrez there, and even when Sterling was in his pomp, and reliable fellas that you know what you're going to get out of them, with a bit of zip and energy as well, on top of chipping in with goals. He's not going to chip in with goals. He's so hit and miss. You don't know what you're getting out of him. Nunes on the other end as well, kind of a strange signing at the time, playing in a different position where he wasn't playing at Wolves. He's not getting the goals. Foden hasn't stepped up this year, who I love, hasn't hit anywhere near the heights of what he did last year. So where's the goals coming from as well, on top of the fact that some of them can't run? When Man City were in their pomp, on top of Haaland scoring all the goals, they still had fellas that were chipping in. De Bruyne was scoring goals, Foden was scoring goals, Mahrez, Sterling, whoever the case may be. They've no one scoring goals for them either. Walker's legs are gone, so they've major problems, Man City. Like, it's one thing saying, oh come on, liven up lads, they can't run.
Is that just years of
yeah, and that was going to come at some point, to be fair. Like, they've gone in deep into the four competitions for the last 4, 5, 6 years. They've played an unbelievable amount of games, more than any other team, I think, when I read up on it there a couple of years back, over the last 2 or 3 years, or since COVID, I think they've played more than anyone else. So of course that's the mileage that's on the clock with a lot of them, and that's where, as I say, the manager needs to freshen it up. Or He's persistent with Gundogan and Silva. Like, I said it here a few weeks ago, Marie. I seen Gundogan playing for Barcelona last year, and I could run faster than him. He can't move.
Pep doesn't seem like the type of person, though, that takes on other people's opinions on board. Like, once he's decided and made up his mind on something, he's doing it.
Yeah, and that's fine if it's going well for you. But if it's not going well for you,
he's not used to not going well.
He's stubborn. He's too stubborn. And sometimes he can be too stubborn for your own good. And in some ways, I like the fact that he's set on his ways and you stick to your guns. But if it's not working for you, you have to change. It's like my criticism of Postecoglou at the moment. Absolutely love Postecoglou, but if it's not working for you, you have to change. Yet he's coming out with phrases like, are you not entertained, mate?
Right, that was a great interview last night.
The interview last night was great, to be fair, and I really hope it works out for him. But certainly for Guardiola at the moment, who has been phenomenal manager, don't get me wrong, he's been unbelievable, the football, the play, all that kind of stuff, what he did at Barcelona. But when things are not going well, you have to change, you have to try something new. And he needs to step up. This nonsense that he's coming out with, I'm not good enough, like, that's like child stuff. Like, come on, Pep, liven up.
I was also watching Arteta's press conferences today, Fergal, and he's marked 5 years now since he has taken over Arsenal. It just shows how quick the time has gone by, and they're playing Crystal Palace tomorrow. But it seems they haven't won a Premier League, but he's turned them into title contenders, and they're going really well most of the time, but you just feel like he needs to get over the line. Is he going to get over the line, do you think?
There's still obviously still a huge amount of time to go, and
I'm only asking because he was 5 years in the job and he was all talking about it today, so it's like, what's
it's a
success?
Long time, 5 years.
Yeah.
I think ultimately, because of the money that he spent and the fact that he's not been shy about acknowledging that for a team like Arsenal, a Premier League title has to be the objective. He couldn't go into that job or be a certain time in that job and still be talking about top four is the goal, and you know, we're doing very well and maybe we'll get a cup. He knows that Arsenal fans, considering how long it's been, that's what they want to hear from their manager. It hasn't obviously been backed up in terms of trophies won. Manchester City have been so superb. Liverpool have won the title during his time there, and obviously are leading the way now. So I think it has to be, because there's the constant conversation about the money that he's spent. But I think more importantly, the fact that he's acknowledged, I have to be in that conversation of Arsenal winning a Premier League or getting them very, very close, as he has done in the last two seasons. But I don't think, as it stands, he's made enough of what's going on at Manchester City. Arsenal were very, very close to them last season. The expectation was that it would be Arsenal and City toe-to-toe all the way through this campaign. Liverpool have been very, very good, but they've really capitalised on City wobbling. Arsenal haven't. There's been an opportunity in the last 6 weeks for Arsenal to go, let's get in while the going's good, as Chelsea have done, and really, really put it up to Liverpool and make sure that City don't have an opportunity to claw this back, that we can kind of fulfil the momentum from the last 2 years. And they haven't done that. And I think that will raise some pretty big questions of him at the end of the season, because as it stands now, no, I don't think they'll win the Premier League this season, and that will only stretch on that kind of thing hanging over his head that they haven't won the title since he's come back to the club.
I think they're banging the race, Marie, and I tell you why. The last, you go through their form at the moment, right? Their last nine games in all competitions, they've won six and drawn three. The biggest killer for them, and Fergal alluded to it there, drawing with the likes of Everton at home, that's a killer. That's a sucks the life out of you when you're going for a title race. The one before that, they drew away to Fulham. Fulham are decent. Fulham are having a good season. That's a difficult game. So I take Fergal's point that they haven't capitalised, but they've come through their blip with no Odegaard and a couple of injuries that they've had. They've those players back now, Marie. And if you go back to last season as well, when everybody was writing them off, I think it was just before Christmas, they had a horrendous run and they lost four or five games, and they came back after Christmas, after the mid-season break, after I think the cup, and they went on an unbelievable run till the end of the season. I think they could have come out of their blip, and I think they could go on a run. Now, the only criticism I have with Arsenal, and I think Arteta's done a phenomenal job, and I thought this was the year that they would go on and win the league, and I'm still tipping them. I'm not going to change now. The centre forward issue. Now, Jesus got a couple during the week, but you can't be relying on him. He's persistent with Havertz, and I just think to get them over the line, there's a player up at Newcastle who's ready-made for Arsenal. He'd score a bucket load with Arsenal, Isak. And why they haven't gone after him is beyond me, Marie, because there's plenty of money at Arsenal. That's not an issue. I don't know why they haven't gone after someone as an out-and-out number nine, and if it's not Isak, go after someone else. But to persist with Havertz, I think that'll be their downfall if they don't get over the line. If they can address that maybe in January, and people will argue, well, it's hard to get top quality in January unless you spend big money, but I definitely think if they go and try and break the bank for Isak, that'll get them over the line.
We've had this conversation though about whether or not they need somebody in that position, and
yeah, and last year they didn't, because they were all chipping in with the goals and the stats were backing up. Saka, Martinelli, Odegaard, they're not chipping in with the goals this year. Martinelli is struggling bad. Saka is still doing his thing, he's phenomenal. They're a little bit too reliant on him. In fairness, last year Martinelli was stepping up, Trossard was scoring a few, Odegaard was, that's not happening this year. So now there's even more scrutiny on Havertz not scoring because the others are not helping him out, and whereas they were last year. And I just think you won't get long term, that's fine, I think Havertz, short term for a season, 18 months, you won't get over the line consistently. When you compare what Liverpool have up front compares to what Arsenal have, and that could be the difference come the end of the season, because Liverpool are electric up front, and even the odd day when they might have an off day defensively, even though they're good defensively, but the odd day they might, they'll have fellas match winners. Jota comes on last week, they're down to 10 men, a moment of magic, a turn finish on the edge of the box. Salah's doing it for years. That's the difference. And I just think with Havertz, he could cost them, Havertz, and that's down to Arteta not addressing the centre forward issue.
So Fergal, Postecoglou said in his post-match interview last night, are you not entertained? Are we going to be entertained on Sunday at 4 o'clock when Spurs and Liverpool face off?
7-0.
Absolutely. This could be the perfect game to kind of sign everybody off for Christmas. Loads of goals, loads of action, loads of nonsense, and another press conference from Postecoglou. I was covering the game last night and waiting for his quotes to come in, and they're always good value, and last night was even more so. It was a wild game, neither goalkeeper covering themselves in glory. It kind of could have gone any way, Tottenham obviously eventually getting over the line, and they've also drawn Liverpool in the Carabao Cup for January. I still think you just cannot rely on this ability to win certain games and win it with a flourish and win it with a bit of style. They keep going back to the Manchester City win from a few weeks back, and obviously they battered Southampton last weekend as well. But Liverpool are in the position that they are in because they don't allow those type of things to happen. They win games with control. That's what wins titles, that's what wins cups. Having control, quality, ruthlessness. Spurs do have all of those things, but there's still too much chaos, and they're obviously missing some really important players. Romero and Van de Ven not being there has been massive. It's ripped a massive hole out the middle of their defence and caused them a lot of problems. I fancy Tottenham to score. I fancy them to make a game of it. They have goals, they've got lots of creativity, but Liverpool are just a machine, a unit in this type of situation. They can weather that pressure and possibly maybe even fall behind, because they've got so much confidence in the ability of a Salah, a Luis Diaz to go and just win the game. Once Tottenham have maybe kind of ran themselves out a bit, they'll just take the game away from them and go away and win it. because that's still Tottenham's main issue. They can impress and amaze and entertain, but they can't win 3-4 games on the run and put themselves realistically into the conversation for the top four this season.
I can't wait for this game. Last night was unbelievable. It really was.
Brilliant.
Last night was unbelievable. I couldn't believe what I was watching, honestly. And they were so good for that first hour, in total control. And I'm getting text messages and lads are saying, surely they can't blow this. And I'm saying, lads, this is the night. They're home and hose cruising. And next thing, the chaos starts. And it's a great watch, it really is. But if you're trying to analyse it like we are, I agree with Fergal. You can't. It's not sustainable, Marie. It's not. I love Postecoglou. I love the approach, all that kind of stuff. But you have to adapt. And Carragher has summed it up twice now. Last week, after I think the Chelsea match, the same last night, I was listening to him, and I agree totally with what Jamie Carragher was saying. You have to adjust to what's happening in the game at that moment in time, and they don't. No matter what's going on, it's just all out attack. I'm going over in a couple
of
weeks.
It's a beautiful game.
I'm going over to watch them in a couple of weeks, and I can't wait. And I'm hoping for a 5-4, right? Put them on the right side.
I think, though, Olive, it was like nil nils all the time.
And
people wouldn't be happy.
No, and that's his argument, Postecoglou. But the big thing with that, Marie, that's fine if you've a load of credit in the bank and you have two big trophies as well waving out at you. Spurs are desperate for a cup, desperate for not even a league, a cup. They won't win the league, but they're desperate for a cup, anything. And if you're trying to win a cup or anything like that, I just don't think this will do it for you. And as much as the approach is amazing and it's great, and he's coming out saying, oh, what do you want? A scrappy 1-0 win. And I know the fans kind of will want, like I was there with Mourinho, the manager, the fella that's at Forest now, Nuno as well, and it was toxic Conte, and it was horrible to watch. Like, and the fans giving out stink, and I get that as well. My only criticism of Postecoglou, and as I said, I'm a huge fan. I love the football, the players they have. I love watching them. Madison, Kulusevski, they're brilliant players. I just think you have to adapt at certain moments, just even for 10 minutes. I'm not saying change your style, just for 10, 15 minutes. Say, you know what, lads, we've the damage done. Shut up shop now. Just sit in. Paro, where are you going? Just sit in beside the centre half and relax for 15 minutes. The boys have done the business up top. But he's hell bent on doing his way, and that's it. And I hope he gets over the line. They've Liverpool in the semi-final over two legs. Mm-hmm. Can you see them beating them over two legs? Probably not, but who knows? I'd love to see him, but I think that's where, Marie, it's all right saying who wants to see a nil-nil. If you have the credit in the bank, fine. But they're desperate to win a cup, and he's there to win a cup.
Is a Carabao Cup enough?
Oh, anything! They'll take anything. They just need a cup. The Carabao Cup could springboard them to something else, as it has done with many other managers. So I think that has to be their priority now. And they have a great chance in the Europa League. Great chance. Go all out to try and win them. But I just think in those moments where it's chaotic, just settle down. Say, like, they were three up, cruising. And then it looked like they were nearly going to lose it.
And it was great. Fergal Brennan, thank you so much. Enjoy the Christmas. We will talk to you soon. Alan, you may hang around for a while because we'll be doing racing with Jane, and we're also going to be talking boxing, music and Fury after these. 2FM. Game on 2FM. Now, welcome back. We are turning our attention to boxing because there is an absolute huge fight taking place tomorrow between Alexander Usyk and Tyson Fury. And I know that so many people are interested in it. Alan?
Oh, I'd be glued to this.
I'd be glued to this.
I'm an Usyk man.
We're actually having a party for the kids. The kids are mad. They must be seeing all the ads on it because, like, even the 10-year-old is going, like, I really want to watch this fight.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of boxing in general, the way it's going and where it's been held, but I will be watching it. But the only plus point is that I think it'll be on about 10 o'clock.
That is it. Exactly. Gavin Casey of the 42 joins us. Gav, how beneficial is it having it at 10 o'clock?
Massively, I would say. The older I get, Marie, I can get used to this, I have to say. I've noticed over the last couple of years my own stamina. We might talk about the two lads involved in the main event, but I tend to struggle when it's a Las Vegas main event at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning these days. It's alarm time, so nice to have it at normal hours. Yeah,
it's absolutely brilliant. And the build up maybe hasn't been as controversial and dramatic as they often are. A couple of face offs, but the trash talk and that seems to have been left behind, which I think is probably added to it because you get to actually think a little bit more about what's going to happen in the ring. And with that in mind, what is going to happen in the ring, Gav?
So, we can skip straight to a prediction. I do feel as though Alexander Usyk just has Tyson Fury's number.
Yeah.
And there are two major factors that come into play to my mind when you're trying to envisage, or envision, I should say, how this fight actually plays out. One of which is that Tyson Fury, as much as he's a year younger than Alexander Usyk, he's carrying around a lot more weight than him throughout his life. He hasn't lived as clean a life, mm-hmm. obviously. And in three of his last six fights, he's either been knocked down or he's been hurt. And I question his to that extent, because in that first fight, in the middle rounds, he was starting to get on top. I think he had turned the tide on Usyk, but Usyk just had that mental fitness, that physical fitness to bend the fight back to his will and hurt Fury. And I kind of consider Usyk to be a slightly better boxer than Fury to begin with. And like, I suppose like that's sort of the second point, is that I've always thought that Usyk is slightly technically better. And where you're going into a rematch, typically speaking, I suppose the onus is on the person who lost to make those adjustments. But I think when you're dealing with a boxer of Usyk's IQ, he can equally make adjustments and possibly make it an easier night for himself the second time around. You're talking about a master technician, somebody who is crafted in Ukraine in an unbelievable high performance program, Olympic champion, and he's converted that to the professional ranks to unbelievable success.
Yeah, he's just, like as you said, he just seems to have figured out Tyson Fury. And I know in the last time there was a lot of talk about whether the size would matter, the height, but he doesn't seem to be troubled by the height difference or anything like that.
He's just so good at boxing, he can box upwards very. And it was fascinating to see the degree to which he was able to apply that mental pressure on Fury, as well as kind of a spatial physical pressure as well, because I really didn't know how he was going to approach that first bout. I thought maybe he'd look to counterpunch a little bit more and use that, again, fractionally better technique than Fury's, but it was his feints, it was the way he laid with his left hand. And he's almost like the conductor of an orchestra, the way he waves that left hand. You never know the angles from which the punch is going to be thrown, and in that ninth round he detonated one where Fury was tiring. And I think that's a key point again. I think if you exert that kind of mental pressure on Fury the second time around, considering how much Fury will be thinking about that first fight and avoiding that kind of an outcome, and how much that can tire a fighter psychologically, I just think there will be an opening there for Usyk again. But you pointed out the size difference. As much as it didn't necessarily concern Usyk from an offensive point of view the first time around, Fury can absolutely hurt Usyk because he's just so much the bigger man. And that is a possibility here. If Fury targets the body, if he tries to be more aggressive from the off, it's easier said than done against Usyk. Of course he has a chance. Like, it's a very close fight, a brilliant rematch. I can't wait for it.
Is the approach from Fury going to help him? He does seem a lot more focused. I was reading Paris's quotes that he hasn't spoken to her in
weeks. She's probably glad of that.
She's probably so busy with all the kids. Is that going to help, or is it like, has the damage been done? As you said, there's kind of blowouts between fights. It's been a different lifestyle. Like, Usyk has been crafted almost in a different way. Or do you think that maybe this more focused approach will help Fury in the ring? And John isn't there either. John Fury, I say that like I know him, John.
I would imagine that will be helped just purely from the communication standpoint in the corner, because there were just too many chefs in the kitchen in that first fight. And this time around, you'll have Sugar Hill Stewart and Andy Lee delivering concise instructions. That's definitely a bonus. In terms of Fury's preparation for it, I think the juxtaposition between both of their approaches to this build-up is stark in that, as you mentioned, Fury has gone off the radar entirely from his family. And when that was put to Usyk, he said, "I've spoken to my wife on the phone every day during training camp." I don't think you should read too much into that from Usyk's side necessarily, but I think it shows the degree to which Fury has felt the need to bring himself to a dark place in order to put this right in his head so that he's mentally prepared for this fight. He's an unbelievably complex character, as everybody knows, and that is really not to say Usyk is a simple one. He has the weight of a war torn country on his shoulders, as he did the first time around. Like, there are things going on in Usyk's life mm-hmm. that we can never even fathom, right? But what I mean to say really is that I think Usyk will have a sort of a clarity of thought about this fight because he's been there and done it, and because he will be able to make some of his own adjustments. Whereas Fury, he tasted defeat for the first time as a professional. You don't know how necessarily he'll respond to that on the night. And as much as I absolutely believe he will be unbelievably focused for this rematch, I just think in Usyk he may see his own personal boogeyman, and history may repeat itself.
Yeah, well, I'm taking a few notes here now, Gav. So when people ask me, like the kids now, when I go home this evening, ask me how it goes on, I'll just be regurgitating everything that you say. So this has been very, very beneficial. So you think Usyk to win? Will it go all the way, do you think?
I have a sneaking suspicion Usyk might stop him this time around. I go back to what I say about just the damage that Fury has taken throughout his career. He's never had, like, there's an oxymoronic quality to his chin in that he's been down, I think, 8 times as a professional, but he's always gotten back up. He has this unbelievable power of recovery. But I do think, like, when you're talking about ginormous men punching each other in the head, the more you go on, you're 36 years old, like, the more that takes its toll. And the fact that Usyk hurt him the first time around, the fact that he is hittable now, at least more so than he used to be, I just fancy Usyk to be able to detonate that left hand maybe even a little bit more early, and I think he may get the job done inside the distance. If it goes wrong, just tell your kids that it was Alan's prediction.
Brilliant, Gav, thank you so much, and here's to lots more at 10 o'clock.
Enjoy, Gav.
Yeah, talk to you soon. Enjoy, Gav. Thanks, Mel. We're going to take another very quick break, but stay with us though, because Jane Mangan is going to set us up for Christmas. You don't want to miss that.
RTE 2FM.
Game on 2FM. Now time to talk racing, and Jane Mangan is with us on the line. Jane, it's going to be such a busy time for you because racing takes centre stage around Christmas. What can we look forward to aside from seeing lots of you?
Oh, you're so kind. I think Christmas is really busy for anybody in hospitality, anybody in entertainment, and anybody with young kids. So you are definitely going to be up the walls as well. But I hope you get to tune in to some of the RTE coverage across the 26th to the 29th. And, you know, if we're going to talk about some of the special races we're going to see, the Irish are going to be well represented across the water at Kempton as well and in Aintree. But it is worth noting, we may as well start our chat, Marie, today. In the midst of the National Hunt winter season, Gavin Cromwell, the Meath man, became the first trainer to train an Irish winner in Bahrain. No doubt far-flung from a lot of our attention, and it certainly escaped my attention as well, that the filly Snellen went over there with Gary Carroll and is bringing home a few pounds.
That's very interesting, isn't
it? Yeah, Gavin Cromwell has had some rise over the last few years, hasn't he, Jane?
Unbelievable. Royal Ascot winners, Cheltenham winners, champion hurdle winner, and no doubt this time of year he's going to be preparing horses like I Know the Way You're Thinking, and some really smart horses for jumping. So I thought it was a really good bit of placing for him to go across to the Middle East and bag a big prize there.
Is he a good example, Jane, of, you know, the argument that breaks out, oh, Willie's dominating everything, or Gordon, and it's tougher for the smaller trainer? But Gavin Cromwell wasn't exactly big when he started out.
No, Gavin Cromwell was Gordon Elliott's farrier, and Gordon Elliott didn't get anything handed to himself on the plate either. I think there's plenty of examples of very good trainers who train when they get the opportunity, and to be fair to Gavin, he's actually making the opportunity for himself, because many people will have, you know, forgotten the flat horses now for a couple of months. We'll wait until the spring and summer for the likes of Snellen to run again, and he didn't think that. He broke out the international programme book. He found a race for her, and maybe she's going to stay out there for a few weeks and try and bag another race before she comes home. But that's the flat. We'll get back onto the jumping. Today, the King George, 3 horses supplemented, including Spillane's Tower for Mom and Dad down in Connacht. They'll be thrilled with that. 2 other horses from France supplemented for the race, leaving 14 remaining confirmations for what looks like a really vintage King George.
Yeah, it's a cracking lineup, Jane. Come on, give us the lowdown. Spillane's Tower, I'm looking at a betting list here. 4-1 favourite he's in at.
I know, who'd have thought? The man from Connacht with around 10 horses in training has the favourite for the King George. I think it's a marvellous story already. He's running in the John Durkin Tells You All You Need to Know, Alan. You know, he's just denied by fact of file. Galopin de Champ was second, or was third, and Fast and Slow was fourth. I think that's the strongest bit of form going into the race. The boat is booked. Mary and Jimmy are booked on a flight.
Lovely.
Jimmy hasn't been on a plane for around 20 years. I was worried that his passport wouldn't be in date, but it is. But it's not an easy race. Like, Grey Dawning, very good horse. Il est Français, if on his day, I think he's a very special horse, capable of a huge performance. Banbridge for Joseph O'Brien ran a really good prep when unseating behind an Ergamine at Cork. Take in the Irish horses Corbett's Cross and Anva Allen. Last year's winner Hewick isn't even getting a mention. He's more like 20-1, which is an insult to his ability. It's a cracking race. And then at home at Leopardstown, for anybody who's travelling to Leopardstown, you know, our equivalent to the King George is, of course, the Savills Chase on the 28th, which is going to be run on a Saturday this year. Like, fact to file, reopposing with Galopin de Champ. the rematch after the John Durkin throw in. I know the way, or sorry, I am Maximus from, you know, Aintree Grand National winner from last year. And the forgotten horse of the race, I think, is Gavin or Gary or Gordon Elliott's Jerry Colombe. I wouldn't write him off after what was a disappointing effort at Down Royal. We know he's better than that. He's second in the Cheltenham Gold Cup last year. Those two staying chases are just, if they all turn up, they're really Christmas crackers.
Yeah, it's a great time of year, Jane. And obviously, with, as you say, outlining those two races are special horses, special races. But just, I'm fascinated by this for your dad, like the personal side. What does it mean, I suppose, to have the favourite in the King George at the stage maybe your dad is at now? He probably didn't think he'd have a horse as good as this.
Never. I suppose when you get to your 70s, Alan, and you haven't found him, you start thinking it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
And you know, my family are in there, you know, in racing all their lives, and it's not like we haven't been trying. So it is, I think it's akin to winning the lottery. And I think, you know,
wow,
if Marie goes out and buys 100 lotto tickets and I go out and buy 10, she's 10 times more likely to win the lotto. And like, you know, we know there are trainers who have 100, 200 horses in training more, and we have around 10. So the likelihood of us finding that horse is so slim. And we know, look, he was good last year when he won two grade ones. I think it was actually that John Durkin performance at Punchestown last month that actually everybody started to believe then that actually Jimmy just doesn't have a good horse. He has potentially the horse of his lifetime. And I just hope, touch wood, I'm touching all of the wood, that the dream doesn't, that we don't wake up anytime soon, because at the moment we're really dreaming. And yeah, I think for my dad, it's knocked 10 years off him. It's probably put 10 years on my mother. But there's a lot of people from around Connah, around the village at home, who are going to put in the time and the money and the effort to go to Kempton to watch him. So yeah, he's got a real following.
Well, Jane, you know I love the racing, and I'll be rooting for you this year. Your dad, your mum, the whole oddie, and I hope to God he brings home the bacon.
Yeah, and I echo that as well, Jane. Have a lovely Christmas. Thank you so much for joining us as you do every week and keeping us up to date on all of the racing. If you want some more racing news, although it doesn't really ever get better than Jane Mangan, Ruby is here on Monday and he has some special guests with him as well, and they'll be looking ahead to all of the Christmas racing. Now, before we finish up, it is time to talk rugby, because there is URC action tonight, and it is a pretty big one as well, because you have Ulster hosting Munster at Kingspan Stadium. Michael Corcoran and Ian McKinley are there for us. Michael Corcoran, both teams, are they desperate for a win?
That's a nice way of putting it. I think if there's a stronger word for desperate, I'm not sure what it is, but both of them are suffering from that here this evening. The form, or lack of it, by both teams on the way into this match is pretty poor. 6 wins out of 14 between the two of them. Their record is kind of identical in the sense that they're only separated by 1 point on the log, as people like to call it now, which is the league table to the likes of us. And both of them beaten in Europe last week. As you mentioned, Ian McKinley is here next to me. Ian, there's a kind of interesting to see the way both teams will approach this game this evening in terms of the composition of the side. Ulster short quite a few because of injury. Munster probably slightly stronger than they wanted to be, but both of them so desperately craving a win.
Yeah, I think when you look at the league table, you're looking at Ulster 10th, Munster 11th. That's not the positions that they expect to be in. You know, we're standing here, we're looking at both teams warming up. It is perfect conditions here in Belfast. You're not going to get a better night coming up to Christmas Day here. So hopefully we're in for an exciting game, but ultimately it sort of has a cup feel to it, you know, that both teams really need to get a win. Not even so much to start climbing the league ladder, but just to get that momentum back, as you spoke about, particularly Munster as well. They'll be bitterly disappointed with their performance, let alone the result against Cass last week.
Now, somebody was on to me during the week and I said the ideal outcome is 28 all, 4 tries each.
I'm sure both coaches will be saying slightly different things, but I mean, as I said, I alluded to the conditions here. They're perfect for that open, expansive game, which I know Richie Murphy's trying to develop more and more with Ulster. I think just on paper, I think Munster are slightly stronger, given all the injuries. You know, you think of the players that are out. You've got Peter O'Mahony, Conor Murray, Abrahams the winger. You know, there's a lot of quality players out, but I think they're just shading it slightly, and particularly off the bench. They've got big players to come off and aid in that effort, but hopefully we're in for a fantastic game.
I don't want to be unfair to Ulster, but their confidence can be a little bit brittle, to be fair about it. I mean, if you saw, I was here last week, you know, for the first 60 minutes against Bordeaux, they looked competitive right in the game, and then they were blown away just by the quality of what they had on the bench. If you look at that Munster bench, it's kind of, I would say, stronger than the Ulster bench tonight.
Yeah, and as you said, fell away against Bordeaux, and that probably comes into the squad depth. I mean, all you have to look at, the pivotal position, Aidan Morgan, you know, the amount of games and minutes that he's already played, and he looked shattered with 20 minutes to go, is probably why James Humphreys came on. And it's interesting, you got Jack Murphy, you know, Richie's son, on the bench, and you know, five or six games he's played for Queen's University, that's going to be a serious step up for him if he does get his opportunity. But you know, that's just probably Munster shading it, just given the fact of who they have on the starting team and on the bench, I believe.
How important is John Cooney in terms of him starting, and the experience and the sort of calmness that he will bring to everything?
He is massive. You know, been fortunate enough to have played with and against John, and he's a cult hero. You know, I mean, people talk about how could you fill Ruaan Pienaar's boots, and that's going back many, many years. Yeah. And it's so important. We see his right knee is heavily strapped, but he's a talisman for this team, and he just brings the extra dimension of an attacking threat this year, but still his composure and his accuracy with his kicking and off the tee.
As we said, both teams needing the win. I've heard you kind of say it and sort of allude to it once or twice. You're expecting Munster to kind of slightly shade it, are you?
Slightly shade it. It's going to be, you know, potentially a one score thing, but just given looking at the first 15, you know, given Munster's performance and how poor they were, you know, they need to right those wrongs, and I think just the bench slightly, they've got an upper hand on Ulster.
All right, Ian, listen, thanks for that. And Marie, just if we're looking for an omen at all in terms of this game, both teams played in an A match at Shaw's Bridge, which is only over the road from here, this afternoon. That started at 3 o'clock, and Ulster won that one, so...
Oh. Right,
I don't know,
we'll
have to
wait
and see. I see Richie Murphy down there at the side of the pitch, doing a Jurgen Klopp, where he is, his back turned to his own players, and he's watching everything that Munster are doing.
So there's two omens, right?
So maybe he's taking a leaf out of Klopp's book, I have to say, to be fair. But I think it's going to be a cracking match, to be honest about it. But both teams, as we say, are craving a victory, and there's a fair degree of pressure on both of them, I have to say, because if you win, you're towards the top half of the table. If you lose, you're kind of rooted towards the bottom, with you know, Munster with Leinster coming to Thomond Park, and also with a tricky trip across to the west of Ireland to play Connacht in a couple of days' time. So these back-to-back matches are huge.
Yeah, they really are. Thank you so much, Ian and Michael. Enjoy the match, enjoy the evening, and we will talk to you soon. Alan, that is it from us. Thank you so much for coming in, as you always do. Great company, and sharing all of your insights with us. Enjoy the Christmas. Ruby and Shane will be on next week, so they'll set us up for the rest of the Christmas sport and reflect on all of the weekend's action as well.